All right, I have with me again Scott Ritter, former UN weapons inspector and Marine, to give us insight and information on what's really going on in the Russia-Ukraine war. Scott, thank you so much for joining today's show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so a lot has happened, and I'm sure it's a lot for you to keep up with, but you do an excellent job, and my viewers appreciate your insight. As of today, Poland became the first NATO nation to offer up fighter jets to Ukraine. At the same time, the U.S. Pentagon is saying the United States will not be sending fighter jets. What's your thoughts on why we're not sending fighter jets, and will these jets be able to help Ukraine? What would be the advantage of these jets?
Well, I believe the jets that Poland is providing are MiG-29 fighters. That's a Soviet-era fighter that the Polish Air Force acquired back when they were part of the Warsaw Pact. So these are planes that are, 30 plus years old. They're old airframes. They may have been upgraded to some extent with Western avionics, which is problematic, and I'll get into that in a second for the Ukrainians. Are they equipped to fire Soviet air-to-air missiles, Soviet air-to-ground munitions, or they've been configured to fire NATO equipment? And this is why, even though the airframes are 30 years old, airplanes can last that long, but air-to-air missiles can't. And so if they had Soviet era air-to-air missiles from stockpiles dating back to the 1980s, these missiles would not be functional today. So my guess is that they've been upgraded to handle NATO weaponry, which means it's a different avionic system. And if you're a Ukrainian pilot who's been flying Soviet era fighters with Soviet era missiles, it's going to be a different system. But that's getting into the weeds. There's only four of these aircraft. That's not a game changer. The fact is, it's not going to have any meaningful impact at all. The Ukrainians are, when they put their airplanes up in the air, they tend to get shot down at a very high rate. And I don't think that these aircraft, there's not enough of them to have a meaningful impact on the battlefield. All they're doing is providing more targets for the Russians. And I believe that, unfortunately for the Ukrainians, these aircraft and the pilots in them are going to have a very short life expectancy. Now, the United States is under pressure to provide the F-16 fighter, which is, of course, an American fighter that, for some reason, people think are, some sort of miracle technology. The F-16, like the MiG-29, is old technology. And yes, there are upgraded versions of the F-16 that could be provided, but we're probably not going to provide them because the Ukrainian pilots, again, are trained on the MiG. And anybody here who's an athlete will understand what I'm about to say. Muscle memory. When you train to do something, it's muscle memory. You condition yourself to do the same thing over and over and over again, a repeatable exercise, so that it becomes second nature. A football player, a basketball player, a baseball player doesn't have to think through what they're doing because they've practiced it, and it's second nature. This is the same thing with fighter pilots and military professionals. Whether you're an infantryman doing close quarter combat, you are trained. It's repetitive motion so that when the world starts exploding, you do the same thing. You don't hesitate. The same thing with a pilot. You are trained in a specific airframe with specific avionics, with specific performance characteristics, and it's second nature for you. So a Ukrainian pilot who has extensive experience in a MiG fighter or a Sukhoi fighter, these Soviet-era fighters, if you're going to try and transition him to a F-16 fighter, it's a completely different airframe, completely different avionics, completely different system. And your muscle memory of the MiG is going to interfere with your ability to properly absorb. But this isn't me saying this. This is the experience of a South Carolina Air National Guard unit that does this kind of transition training for former Soviet client states who have now become NATO members. Romania, Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Poland, nations that had MiG fighters who are acquiring American fighters, F-16s. There's a 6-month training program where you transition MiG pilots into F-16 pilots. And what the Air National Guard says is that if you have an experienced MiG pilot, he's actually a very bad F-16 pilot because of the muscle memory issues. When push comes to shove and he's put under stress, he falls back on that which he knows and is comfortable with, and he makes mistakes, he's slower. The pilots that do best are guys with little or no experience of flying a MiG, so they can be solely focused on flying the F-16. And so this is a problem because, the United States, if we're going to provide the F-16, if the best Ukrainian pilots come over, we're actually going to make them worse. They're better off flying the Polish MiG-29s than they are flying American F-16s. And the other thing is the F-16 is not capable of the kind of operations that the Ukrainians require. The F-16 has to fly from an improved airfield, an airfield that has, good runway systems, good logistical. It's a very maintenance intensive aircraft. The Ukrainians are flying from unimproved airfields. Now, the MiG-29 can do that. It's designed to do that. It's a more robust, undercarriage, et cetera. The F-16 can't. There's very few places in Ukraine that it could fly from. Those places are easily identified and targeted by the Russians. To provide the F-16s to the Ukrainians would cost a lot of money, take a lot of effort. And there's that old saying, the squeeze ain't worth the juice. All the effort we're putting in, you're not going to get enough out of it. So the United States has made the right decision not to provide aircraft, which on paper would look like you're upgrading the performance of the Ukrainian Air Force, but in reality, you're degrading it. They're better off getting aircraft that they are comfortable with, they know they can handle. Ukrainians are never going to get enough aircraft to challenge the Russian Air Force in a one-on-one air supremacy battle. The best they're going to be able to do is have aircraft that can harass the Russians, that can harass their troops, that can carry out limited operations. And right now they're doing that with their existing, although severely diminished, Soviet-era air fleet. The MiG-29s, the Sukhoi 27s, the Sukhoi 25s. These are the airframes that the Ukrainians need. They have pilots that can operate them. They have a system, logistic system, that can maintain them. And they are able to do the kind of operations that are realistic. To think you're going to come in with a number of American F-16 airframes and dramatically change the nature of this air battle is naive in the extreme.
Okay. So on the one hand, the United States is smart in that they're thinking through this stuff. On the other hand, unless we're giving them a massive amount of air support, it's just not going to change the trajectory of the war.
Correct.
Okay. Yesterday, General Milley and Lloyd Austin of the Pentagon held a joint briefing. In there, Lloyd Austin said something that was very confusing to me. And yes and no. Okay, this is what he said. He said that Ukraine will be victorious because 50 nations are supporting her, and Russia will not be victorious because only two nations, North Korea and Iran, are supporting them. Are they really believing that this war is going to end depending on how many people are giving you or selling you weapons? That seems so naive to me.
No, you're 100% correct. I mean, the fact of the matter is, this war isn't just a military struggle on the battlefield. This war has an economic aspect to it and a geopolitical aspect to it, a diplomatic aspect to it. The majority of the world does not support what the United States is doing against Russia right now. The majority of the world is either neutral or leaning towards Russia. And that's important when we talk about the economic aspects. You see, one of the major pillars of the American policy approach towards Russia and this conflict with Ukraine was to sanction Russia, thereby undermining their economy, collapsing their economy, creating political pressure on the Russian president. There are some people who have been honest about this. It's called regime change. We saw Kenneth Rogoff, the Harvard professor, member of the G30 banking group, speak at the World Economic Forum in January, I believe, or maybe even February, where he said straight up, sanctions are designed for regime change. And we have the Canadian foreign minister who's come out and basically said the same thing, that we're seeking regime change in Russia using sanctions. But if you talk to Angus King, the independent senator from the state of Maine. He just held a hearing. And Angus King is a big fan of sanctions. He's been promoting sanctions against Russia from day one. But he just held a hearing where he had to say it didn't work. It backfired. And he wants to know why that happened. Why were we promoting a policy that failed across the board, didn't succeed? Russia's economy is stronger now than it was when this war started. The Chinese economy has been reconfigured in a way to not only assist the Russian economic survival in this time of sanctions, but thrive. India's taking Russian energy and doing well on that. The Russians have not been isolated. I don't mean to be facetious, but when was the last time a Russian bank failed? And we can answer that question, when was the last time an American bank failed? So it's not the Russian economy that's having problems. Their economy was supposed to be contracting 25%. It contracted 2% in 2022, and 2023 is expected to grow. And people should reflect on that. The Russian economy is going to grow despite the fact the United States and the entire collective West are sanctioning that economy, and it's a war economy. War economies don't grow. War economies go into deficit spending mode. The Russians are running a budget surplus, which tells you they're doing something right. The sanctions have failed. So Lloyd Austin is completely wrong when he starts throwing out numbers, because the numbers are meaningless. Now we come to the military equipment aspect of it. Nothing Lloyd Austin talks about is going to change the equation that Jan Stoltenberg, the Secretary General, brought up in January, where he honestly said Ukraine is going to run out of 155 millimeter artillery ammunition in the summer, and there's nothing that can be done to change that equation. There's no miracle cure. There's no magic wand. There's nothing that can be done. They're going to run out of ammunition. How does 50 nations equate into Ukraine running out of ammunition if it was functioning the way that Lloyd Austin is insinuating it is? The bottom line is, don't talk about the numbers of nations providing, talk about the quality of the assistance. And the fact of the matter is that quality isn't enough. They're running out of ammunition. The United States has provided $115 billion worth of assistance to Ukraine, most of that in terms of financial assistance, but tens of billions of it in terms of military assistance. And yet the Pentagon has just put forward a budget requirement down the road that says, in order to replace the tens of billions of dollars of equipment that we provide Ukrainians, the Pentagon needs $300 billion. That's a losing economic equation. I mean, I might be a simple Marine and I'm not an economist, but I don't believe that any equation that has you expending tens of billions of dollars and then requiring $300 billion to make up for that has a trajectory that has you going in the right direction. And the United States isn't unique in this. Germany has pretty much acknowledged they've given away everything to Ukraine. They have nothing left. They have troops coming in. They have no helmets for these troops. They have no body armor for these troops. They have no guns for these troops. They have no ammunition for the troops, because everything's been given away to Ukraine, and the Germans cannot afford to acquire the equipment necessary to replace it because prices have gone up. They can't build new tanks because the cost of steel is too high, and yet they're giving away the tanks to Ukraine, but not in enough numbers. It's like the MiG. The tanks that are being provided are insufficient quantity. I think the Spaniards right now are in the process of finalizing, preparing 10 tanks to be transferred to Ukraine. But six of those 10 tanks are in a depot being brought back into service, meaning that they were broken, they were run down, they couldn't operate. So we're giving Ukraine broken tanks that are decades old. We can fix them, but they're going to break again, and Ukraine doesn't have the means to repair them. That's why the 50 is a meaningless number. When they're putting that number out there, it has no gravitas. It's not a serious number. The reality is, the actual quality and quantity of the equipment being provided to Ukraine, and it's insufficient to the task. The Russian defense industry, on the other hand, is cranking up. And here's the sort of the misleading thing. There's no evidence that North Korea is providing Russia with military assistance, none whatsoever. It's an allegation that's put out by the United States, basically for political purposes. But if you think about it, logically speaking, this is an artillery-driven war. And we've heard from the Jan Stoltenberg that Ukraine's going to run out of artillery. That's a game changer. That's, game ender there. When they run out of artillery, the war literally is over at that point in time. Russia uses a lot of artillery ammunition. Now, I'm somebody who believes in studying this problem that Russia's defense industry has been mobilized, and they are producing an awful lot of artillery rounds. One of the numbers that has been put out there is around 420,000 rounds per month. That's a lot of artillery. They need that. That's the fuel for their war engine. Think about that. Think of the Russian artillery as the war engine. The shells are the fuel. So they need 420,000 rounds to keep this thing going. If that was an insufficient number, and Russia's getting ready to launch a major offensive, that means they need more artillery. If they're going to acquire that from North Korea, that means the people who control Russia's fate are the North Koreans, because that's the fuel. Imagine being a race car driver and coming into a pit stop and not being in control of your fuel supply. And so you're pitting thinking, I'm going to get fuel. Now, if your team has the fuel, you can be confident you're going to have the fuel. But if you've delegated this to another team and you pull into a pit stop, but the other team doesn't provide the fuel, you lose the race. Russia will never delegate the fuel to its war engine to a third party, whether it be North Korea, whether it be China. Now, on Iran, it's not that Russia has delegated anything. Russia has bought a specific weapon system from the Iranians, a drone system that helped Russia upgrade its own drone fleet. But while this has provided a qualitative advantage for Russia in certain aspects of the conflict, it's not one that Russia has to have to win. It's a nice to have, not a need to have. So the implication that somehow Iran is underwriting the Russian war effort just shows a level of ignorance about the sophistication of the Russian defense industry and of the Russian military. And I think it was irresponsible for both Lloyd Austin and Mark Miley to make such insinuations, because it creates a false impression.
And maybe that's what they want. They just want the impression of the United States looking generous, but not having to actually fulfill, kind of like, hey, we're going to give you 31 tanks, but we can't get them, you know, until 2024. You know, hey, at least they had good intentions and tried, right? So, okay, going back to Mark Milley, he said in that same conference that Russia, their military is making mindless moves with vast numbers of untrained soldiers. You know, there could be some truth to that, but it does seem that Russia has become significantly more organized in the last 90 to 120 days. Is he using old intel, or is there some truth to what he's saying?
No, there's no truth to what he's saying. It's not even that he's using old intel. What's happening right now, and it's happening across the board, is what I call mirror imaging, meaning that Ukraine is right now in a state of imminent collapse. Their military is becoming virtually dysfunctional. And one of the reasons is they're running out of manpower. So Ukraine is going around and literally kidnapping people off the streets, including 14 and 16 year old boys who are showing up on the front line with 3 days of training. So they're kidnapped from the streets of Odessa, given 3 days of training. They end up in Bakhmut and they die. This is happening in massive numbers. And this is a public relations problem for the Ukrainians. So what we're doing is we're mirror imaging the problems of Ukraine onto the Russians. But the Russians aren't doing that. The Russians mobilized 300,000 men in September. The vast majority of those men are still undergoing training. So the notion that these are poorly trained troops is just absurd in the extreme. These were military reservists who already had served in the military, had a modicum of experience. And instead of being thrown straight into the fight, they're being sent to a training area where for now, September, October, November, December, January, February, we're coming up on 7 months of training to get them ready to form on the battlefield. So, you know, Mark Milley is just making this up. It's not what's happening. The Russians are extraordinarily well-equipped. They have modern equipment, modern tanks, modern artillery. They have body armor. They have everything they need, and they're trained to do this job. These are not poorly trained troops. And they're not throwing them in human wave assaults. The fact of the matter is the casualty ratio right now is insane. Normally in a war, the offense versus defense is you want a 3-to-1 advantage from the offense to defense, because generally speaking, you're going to take more casualties than the defender. So you need that kind of advantage. The Russians right now are operating with parity in numbers when it comes to infantry, but superiority in numbers when artillery. But on the casualty ratio, they're killing Ukrainians sometimes as high as 16 to 1 in a day. Sometimes it drops down to 10, sometimes it drops down to 8. But that, what that means is, if you on the best day the Ukrainians are having, for every 800 Ukrainians that die, they're killing 100 Russians. But on the worst day, for every 100 Russians that die, 1,600 Ukrainians die. And the Ukrainians are having a lot of bad days, not so many good days, but even their good day is a nightmare. It's Ukraine that's chewing through its troops at a rate that's unimaginable. And I think it was Lloyd Austin that threw out a number, casualty number of 100,000. I think in the same presentation, he talked about 100,000 dead. But he knows that's a lie. He knows that he was reported to by General Zeluzhny of the Ukrainian army last month that Ukraine had suffered close to 250,000 dead, on top of which there are 83,000 missing, most of whom are dead, which means that Ukraine has suffered around 320,000 dead. That's the honest number. But Lloyd Austin can't be honest about that, because that's a number that just boggles the mind. If you look at the combatant losses of the United States in World War II, in both the Pacific Front and the European Front, we didn't lose 320,000 dead. We lost fewer than that in terms of combatant deaths, people who died in combat. Ukrainians have lost 320,000 combatant deaths in 1 year. That's a ridiculous number. That's a sickening number. And it reflects the reality of what's going on the ground in Ukraine today. And Lloyd Austin and Mark Milley can't be honest about that, because if they were, American people would say, then we need to bring this war to an end, because this is just resulting in the death of people that we claim to be supporting.
Yeah, I spoke recently with Colonel McGregor, and he said that the United States, this is a humanitarian crisis now, and that they owe it to Eastern Europe to switch gears and sue for peace and withhold weapons and support until they seek peace. But for some reason, they continue to defer to Zelensky to decide, when is there peace? When is this over? What does winning and losing look like? How much money and weapons do you need? Why is the United States continuing to give Zelensky so much authority over this war, when it's obvious that it's the United States and the United Kingdom and Germany and Poland driving the majority of the rhetoric and the equipment into the war?
That's a very good question. To answer that, we have to understand the quality of the advice being given to the President of the United States. You know, right off the bat, when you have senior people admitting that the policy was regime change, that we wanted to put in sanctions and create political pressures to bring down Vladimir Putin, it tells you two things. One, there is a very strong anti-Putin animus existent in the U.S. government. And two, there's a level of ignorance about Russia that is mind-boggling. I'm not going to brag, but you know, back in December, I said, if we implement these sanctions, Russia will emerge stronger, intact, and it will be the Western economies that begin to collapse. I was proven 100% correct. Why? Because I have taken the time to study Russia, understand Russia, and understand the realities of their economy. But to do that, I have to cut through the fiction that's been put up there about, for instance, that Russia is a nation ruled by one man, Vladimir Putin, the all-seeing, all-knowing, all evil dictator who controls everything, instead of recognizing the reality that Russia is a very large country where control has been delegated to regional authorities who manage their individual regions, who come together using a bureaucracy to create a consolidated, unified policy that's then taken up to Putin, who oversees it, you know, as a manager, as the chief executive, but not as a dictator. If you understand what I say is the reality, then you're able then to take the time to read the position papers that are put out there. The Russians are telling us what they're doing. They don't lie. They are a very transparent society. Their budget is published. The documents that are used to create that budget are published. And people need to take the time to read that. But if you do that, then it takes away your ability to say, well, Vladimir Putin is the personification of evil. Because if you take the time to study Russia and learn Russia, you realize he's just a very effective manager of a very complex and expansive you know, nation. Joe Biden is surrounded by what I call the Putin whisperers. This is a group of people who came into academic maturity at the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the decade of the 1990s, when the goal of the United States was to keep Russia down, to weaken it economically, control it politically, and if necessary, to break it up into constituent parts that would forever keep it weak and never able to rise up and challenge the United States in the way that the Soviet Union had done during the Cold War. These are people like Michael McFaul, Fiona Hill, Angela Stent, and others who, you know, have written their PhD thesis on authoritarian rule and Vladimir Putin. These are people who supported Boris Yeltsin's government and are resentful that Putin emerged from the post-Yeltsin period to try and unify Russia and make Russia strong again, which he has done. Whether you like Putin or you dislike Putin, you have to acknowledge that he has taken Russia out of, you know, the swamp that Boris Yeltsin had created in the post-Gorbachev, post-Perestroika era, and he has taken Russia up to be one of the most strong, the strongest and most resilient economies. People talk about infrastructure. In the United States, of course, we have concerns about infrastructure. We have rail cars derailing, we have bridges collapsing, et cetera. People don't like to talk about the fact that Vladimir Putin has just succeeded in expanding the Russian subway around Moscow. And if you go on the subway, we'll put anything New York City has to shame instantly. The totality of the Russian subway, it's modern, it's clean, it's efficient, it's everything we would want our infrastructure to be, and everything we claim the Russian infrastructure can't be, because if he's a dictator ruling over this dysfunctional country, how could they possibly produce that? But the Russians produce a lot of good things. It's a nation that's on the rise. And I'm not saying that because I want to sing its praises. I'm saying it because that's real. That's, you can't solve a problem unless you first accurately define the problem, because any solution you come up to a problem that's not accurately defined isn't a solution at all. It's nothing. To discuss Russia as a problem, we have to describe it accurately, and it can't be described accurately if you're putting everything on the shoulders of Vladimir Putin and you're trying to describe him as this evil character, which of course all senior Americans doing, whether they're in the Pentagon or they're in the White House or they're in Congress, you will not see a single person say what I just said about the reality of Russia. Instead, Congress holds hearing after hearing where they bring in these Putin whisperers who say over and over again about how bad Russia is, how poorly it performs, how dysfunctional it is, and how dictatorial Vladimir Putin is. That's just not the truth.
Yeah. Okay, speaking of Putin and politicians, yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham called for the U.S. military to start shooting down Russian warplanes anytime they enter international waters. This is his reaction to the Russian fighter jet taking down the Reaper drone over the Black Sea. What kind of repercussions would there be for the United States if we start shooting down Russian warplanes?
Well, the potential for all-out war. I mean, Russia is not going to let that happen. They would challenge us militarily, and then we would end up in a force-on-force conflict that neither side can afford to back down from. So it turns into total war, and then that has the potential of turning into a nuclear exchange, and then this conversation is moot because we're going to be dead. That's what Lindsey Graham needs to, you know, understand. And that's what the people who listen to Lindsey Graham need to understand. He's a very dangerous man right now. I know he's a United States senator. I know he's allowed to speak his mind and, you know, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that people who are listening to him should treat what he's saying as if it is the truth. He is speaking in a very dangerous manner. First of all, he said that he implied that Ronald Reagan would never allow something like this to happen. Well, with all due respect, Lindsey Graham, I was in the military as a Soviet expert during the Reagan administration, and we let it happen all the time because, you know, the idea of flying provocative mission profiles with aircraft or with ships didn't begin today. And people should be under no, you know, misconception here. What we did with the Reaper was a provocation. We took an intelligence collection platform, flew it in an area that the Russians know, that we know is very sensitive to Russia, right off the coast of the Crimea Peninsula, one of the most heavily militarized areas in Russia, during a time of war when the United States has a history of collecting intelligence, giving it to Ukrainians so they can target the Russians. So the fact that we're flying an intelligence collection profile in support of Ukraine along the Russian coast is in itself an act of war. This isn't a peaceful exercise. We are being provocative, deliberately so. Two, the Russians have created an exclusion zone and have announced that to the United States, saying that you cannot fly in this area because we have sensitive military activity taking place. That is required under international law. But what we're saying is that because Crimea is Ukrainian, not Russian, the Russians illegally occupied it, Russia has no ability to put an exclusion zone in on what is Ukrainian territory, so we disregarded it. So we sent a $32 million aircraft into this exclusion zone with a sensitive intelligence collection pod, collecting intelligence that when it's returned will be given to the Ukrainians to plan military operations against the Russians. And we're shocked that the Russians took the plane down. So Lindsey Graham is wrong. Marco Rubio, who also came out and spoke about this, is wrong. This wasn't the United States innocently trying to exercise freedom of navigation. This was the United States carrying out a purposefully provocative military operation that makes the United States an active participant in an ongoing conflict. And so if you see it in that perspective, you realize what we did was horribly irresponsible. And now Lindsey Graham is talking about escalation by bringing in, you know, manned fighter aircraft in a way that's designed to create a force-on-force incident with the United States and Russia. This is bad policy. Fortunately, I don't see the Pentagon or the White House going down this path because there are saner minds out there than Lindsey Graham or Marco Rubio.
Okay, so they're going to be ignored. Okay, that's good. Okay, this has been really great. In our last couple minutes together, on our last meeting, you talked about being a part of a team that put together a treaty that literally saved the world from, I believe, nuclear war. I would like to hear about that.
Sure. I just wrote a book about it, Disarmament, the Time of Perestroika, Arms Control and the End of the Soviet Union. It's about the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF Treaty. Intermediate nuclear forces are ballistic missiles or cruise missiles with a range between 500 and 5,000 kilometers. These were systems that were deemed to be extremely destabilizing in the European environment. The United States deploying Pershing II missiles, for instance, into West Germany, gave us the ability to strike Moscow 7 minutes after launch, which means the Russians had no warning time if this was launched. So Russia would push the button and fire everything. And that time, everything included SS-20 road mobile missiles, very difficult to target, each of which had three nuclear warheads aimed at European cities. So this was the scenario with these weapons in place. The Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty made the decision to get rid of these weapons, a very bold decision. It was a decision made by Ronald Reagan, who is one of the most conservative presidents we've ever had, a man who called the Soviet Union the evil empire, a man who once joked about launching missiles against the Soviet Union, and Mikhail Gorbachev, a reformist who took the Soviet Union away from the policies of the past, tried to lead them down a new road through what we called the reforming, the perestroika, restructuring of the Soviet Union. They came together in December of 1987 and signed this treaty. What made this treaty unique isn't just the fact that we were getting rid of perhaps the most dangerous weapons in the world, but how we were doing it. Prior to this, we had other arms control agreements, but we never had the ability to do serious compliance verification, you know, and that controlled the kind of treaty we could get into. You have to have confidence that the other side isn't going to cheat. But if you're not allowed to allow humans on your soil, for instance, the Russians would never allow Americans on their soil, and we would never allow Russians on their soil because we distrust one another. So the level of confidence in compliance is very low. So you don't want to make a treaty that assumes good things are going to happen. Trust, but verify. That was Ronald Reagan's mantra for the INF Treaty. And the key to verification was people like me, who became inspectors. And we were the first time in the history of arms control that on-site inspections took place, where teams traveled to the Soviet Union, Soviet teams traveled to the United States, and personally oversaw the implementation of this treaty. My role was unique in that I was involved in what they call perimeter portal monitoring. The Soviets had a factory in Vodkinsk, which is a city about 750 kilometers due east of Moscow in the foothills of Ural Mountains that used to produce the SS-20 missile that I talked about with the three warheads. Well, that missile's supposed to be destroyed. But then the Soviets said, well, the factory also produces the SS-25 missile, which is an intercontinental range missile, which is permitted, but the first stage is the exact first stage that was on the SS-20. So now we have to monitor production to make sure that the Soviets aren't using SS-25 production to create a covert production line of SS-20s. And that's where I came in. We built a facility to monitor production out there using giant X-ray machines, visual inspections, the whole works. This was a unique experience. I mean, it was unprecedented in the history of arms control. And we succeeded despite all of the obstacles. I mean, this is a part of history that not too many Americans are familiar with. But it was one of the most amazing experiences you can imagine, because we literally, despite all the obstacles, the history of prejudice between the United States and the Soviet Union, we broke through that to create a cooperative working environment with Russia. And think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Today, people say, how could Russia ever and the United States ever again work together? In the 1980s, the relations were just as bad as they are now. Some people would say worse. And we found a way, engaging in arms control, working in a cooperative fashion to eliminate these missiles and make the world a better place to live. We could do it again. So this experience of the INF Treaty is not just history, pretty cool history, but it's also a template of hope of how we could go forward. But here's the bad news. We're not doing arms control right now. The last remaining treaty has been frozen by the Russians, accusing the United States of using the treaty to achieve this strategic defeat. Remember when I talked about the lunacy of these Putin whisperers talking about we want regime change in Russia? Well, think about it now from the Russian perspective. The United States openly admits it wants to bring down your regime. The weapons that protect you from this, your strategic nuclear force, are here, and you just upgraded them with missiles that can defeat an American missile defense system, which is related to a treaty the United States withdrew from. And now the Americans want to inspect that while not allowing your inspectors into the United States. The Russians said, this is insane. We're not going to do it. They froze it. The treaty expires in February of 2026. That's not very long from now, less than 3 years. On average, it takes 3 to 5 years to negotiate a good treaty. So we're already behind the power curve. We're probably not going to get a negotiation in place until after the 2024 elections because of the political nature of it, which means we are going to have less than a little bit more than a year to get a new treaty in place. If we don't, there's no arms control. Both sides are in the process of modernizing their nuclear forces. We will have an arms race without any control, one mistake, one miscalculation, one misjudgment, and we have a general nuclear war, and again, we all die. The INF Treaty, I believe, saved the world from imminent destruction. If we didn't have an INF Treaty, there would have been a mistake that could have caused the world to end. We need to get a new arms control treaty in, and I think people listening here have to understand the importance of arms control and should do everything possible to put pressure on their respective elected officials to make arms control the number one policy of the United States, because it literally means saving the lives of future generations of Americans. Without arms control, the prospect of the ability of humanity, of humankind to continue is dim.
Wow. Incredible. Incredible. Thank you so much for taking time to share this information with my YouTube community, keeping us in the loop on what's going on in Ukraine, Russia, and right here at home in the United States. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me.